Hey there, gang. Patrick King here, and I want to thank you for tuning in for episode number 17 of Talking About Horses. In these broadcasts, I try to bring you some of the best riders, horsemen, trainers, equine advocates, and thought leaders in the horse industry for tips, insights, and stories. You can listen at home, at work, in the car, or in the saddle through Facebook, YouTube, or by downloading the podcast from the iTunes store. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Gerd Hauschmann. Dr. Hauschmann trained as a Bereiter, riding master in Germany before qualifying for veterinary study at Munich University. There, he specialized in equine orthopedics for 2 years before accepting a post as the head of the breeding department at the German Equestrian Federation, which he eventually left to start his own practice in Warendorf. He's been an active member of the hyperflexion or roll cur debate, weighing in at the 2005 USDF National Symposium and the 2006 FEI Veterinary and Dressage Committee's workshop. His book, Tug of War, and his DVD, If Horses Could Speak, are international best sellers. And I have a copy of both of those, and I'll tell you they're great. He's also published and been a part of other books, including Balancing Act, In Deference, and most recently, Collection or Contortion, Exposing the Misconceptions and Exploring the Truths of Horse Positioning and Bend. Dr. Hauschmann, thank you so much for joining us on tonight's broadcast.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to our nice evening.
Oh, fantastic. So I know we've got a lot of folks already tuning in. And for anybody who's not quite familiar with you, can you give us a little bit more information on who Dr. Hauschmann is and kind of where your position is in the equine industry?
Okay, well, he's a normal guy from Germany who tries to learn to ride every day a little bit better.
Oh, good. So you're just like the rest of us then.
Yes, exactly. And well, I grew up with horses, and I made many mistakes, many things I criticized. I probably did on my own years before, so it's easier to understand if you made the mistakes on your own.
Yeah, for sure.
I left my horse clinic, my horse hospital, or I gave my part to my friends and started to make my living with teaching again. I'm a trainer now, and I try to spread the word for classical riding philosophy for our old culture. I try to turn the wheel a little bit backwards to the classical riding, away from the horse industry. Yeah, that's more or less what I do today.
There we go. I like the way you said that, turning it back to classical riding. And that's, I have a feeling we're going to have quite a discussion about that tonight.
Okay, yeah, I'm ready for
Fantastic. Fantastic. So, most of our listeners probably know of you either through your clinics or your lectures. And I know I first heard of you through this idea of hyperflexion and roll cur. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
I would say since the 80s, last century, especially in Europe, Germany and the Netherlands, a training method came up which created a very round, hyperflexed, to use my words, a two round neck in front of the horse, which, to use some Europeans' words, makes it easier to train a horse to higher level dressage. Or jumping, and it became quite fashionable in Europe, and I think also in this country. Finally, I think most of the people, riders who use the system, have to agree that you destroy too many horses doing this. It's just not correlating to animal welfare ideas, and this method also leads absolutely into the other direction. So it's if classical riding is to the left, this is the turn to the right.
Gotcha. Now, when they say that it makes it easier to train the horses to a higher level, what are they talking about with that?
Well, maybe it's easier to mechanize a horse and to get a quick result. Our classical system is based on, and I think we will talk about this today also, about on a contact, which is built out of a nice, rhythmic, soft, forward, swinging horse. So the horse would pick up the contact, you make an offer, and the horse takes it, and the round pole is finally the result of this soft impulse floating through the back into your hands. And in the Rollcore, I would say it's not only the rider's fault. Our modern horses curl in very easily. They have beautiful, nice necks now compared to horses 100 years ago. So if there's some tension coming up in the back, the modern horse would curl. In the old days, the horse would take the nose up and fight the contact. Today, they curl in. And it's of course not so easy to explain a young person, not so educated person, that this round neck in his 3-year-old is not correct, and because it looks as if the horse is already 8 or 10 years old, so it looks the same more or less. Mm-hmm. How can you explain this young rider that this is wrong in this case? You have to have a little bit more knowledge about this to transport this fact. It's a catastrophe for the horse if it's too round, too short, too deep in the first months. And so, yeah, they just go down the road. They don't correct it. They just take it. The horse starts to run. The more it curls, the more they run. And so you have to use the reins to hold him back. And so the neck curls in more and more. And finally, you are in the roll court.
Gotcha. So as like we said, kind of the horses of an older age would pick the nose up in the air in resistance, and certainly there are plenty that still would have the tendency to do that. But a lot of the more modern bred horses, like you say, kind of have the rubber neck syndrome. So it's easy for them to come behind. So the coming behind, the coming into roll cure, is just as much of an evasion as it is a trained position then.
Yeah, this is my explanation. Of course, they, some people in Europe made this horse's reaction to a training system. There is an old saying from some old master's books. I can give you millions of quotes. They say the young horse in the first months has to go with a long neck and a hanging nose. So very similar to a properly trained quarter horse. You want the neck down and you want the nose out first.
Yes.
But of course, it doesn't look as sexy as a round neck. And this is a problem.
Right, right. Boy, we're all about the look now, aren't we?
Exactly.
So now compare this, if you would, and I think we're kind of getting into that with this, the idea of long and low versus the idea of low, deep, and round. Because low, deep, and round is kind of another term, isn't it, for what is known as roll curve?
Yeah. It's just an excuse. It's just a different word. People who came up with this term, LDR, hyperflexion, and so on, wanted to step away from this word hyper. Flexion, because the name itself, hyper, says it's much. So, and LDR probably sounds better, but finally it's the same. It's the horse behind the bit, and the curling horse has two possibilities to react to this. The majority of the horse to run and speed up, and the horse has to, the rider has to hold them back on the reins, and the minority slows down and doesn't want to go forward anymore. Yeah, so you lose balance. To make the long story short, you use balance. This means the back is not in self-carriage anymore. Longissimus dorsi, the biggest muscle in the back, grazes and causes all the symptoms we know. The horses are hard to sit. They're bouncy. The crookedness increases. The horse hangs on the stiff, on the inside rein of the stiffer side. The other rein is loose. The horse would not take this rein. The horse starts to get loss of rhythm. They are irregular in trot, especially. This can lead to rein lameness. You get all the contact problems: horse behind the bit, against the bit, grinding teeth, fighting contact, going against as soon as you want to do a hop hold, tilting, tongue problems, all this.
And all of this is the result, basically, of coming to round, rushing, coming behind the hand into this hyperflexion position.
Exactly. But I have to say, of course, I think it's not only hyperflexion, it's also the other extreme, an artificially high and short neck. So if you put the horse in an absolute rising of the forehand too high, and they pull the horse in with a higher neck position, you get a similar result. The back would drop, haunches stay back, the horse would not swing forward with the hind legs. I would say even a higher percentage is training in this system than in the Ronco hyperflexion. I think it's more or less out, only a few not knowing people still go with it. But the majority have the horses in a too high show frame, which is causing similar symptoms.
Gotcha. So this is more what we would refer to as the maximum elevation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And so
this is not a relative elevation, which is connected to the ability of the horse to sit behind. This is an artificial elevation, which is breaking the horse in the middle.
Okay, so for our listeners out there that maybe aren't sure the difference then between the maximum elevation or the artificial elevation and the relative elevation, can you give us a little description of each of those and how they're different?
Okay, I try as good as I can with my horrible English. horse's pelvis is connected to the lumbar spine in the lumbar sacral joint. So you can, let's say you can pick up the picture. The horse's pelvis looks like your hand and your forearm down to the elbow. Your hand is the part of the pelvis pointing higher, being above the spine, and the rest of your lower arm is below the spine. So if your horse gallops or canters forward, and the seat bones, the lower part of the pelvis, it goes forward under the horse's body, this higher part, our hand, to stay with our example, goes backwards. Our hand, this part above the spine, is a contact area of the longissimus dorsi. The longissimus dorsi is covering the whole trunk to the cervical spine. So this means, and it's connected to the cervical spine, C4, C5, C6, C7, the last four vertebrae in the cervical spine. So as soon as your horse canters, for example, you know this very well, haunches jump under, seat bones come down, the higher part of the pelvis goes up and backwards. In the same moment, the neck comes up. So why does this happen? Longissimus dorsi and the nuchal and supraspinous ligament, these two structures connect the pelvis with the head and the cervical spine. Pelvis goes down, head comes up. The horse jumps on the ground, pushes off, pelvis goes flat, neck goes down. So they act together. The neck and the pelvis are sort of balanced, they go together. If you influence the neck position without respecting the pelvis position, it is on the cost of the back. The back sinks. So you lose the back in between. A well-balanced horse is always, the neck position is always sort of fitting to the pelvis position. Then you ride a horse in balance. This is a short term. You can read details in the books.
Yes. Yes. Gotcha. And I just flashed on the screen for our viewers a couple of the diagrams that are in your book, Tug of War. Uh-huh. I have it sitting here with me. So I think that's great. That's great.
Yeah. Okay. When I think many of our listeners, rode bareback. And if you ride bareback, you just need to walk and you feel the back muscle move under your seat. You know how this muscle is sort of the most important center of motion, and if you sort of abuse this center of motion and you make this back carrying weight, so this muscle has to brace and carry weight, because you take the neck away, you shorten the neck artificially with your hands, or you accept the curling, you sort of break the horse in the middle, the hind legs stay out, and the neck does things we don't like. You don't get a contact.
Right, right. Okay, so I would imagine some of this, or maybe all of this, is in your new book, Collection or Contortion, is that right?
Well, Balancing Act is the book which builds up the basics,
okay,
which explains the basic biomechanics, and Collection and Contortion, this is the English title. My German title is a little bit more, how must I say, normal. It's about lateral flexion and bend. It explains in detail, based on Mr. Steinbrecht's Gymnasium of the Horse, how to work through the bend in the rib cage in the trunk to the true collection. And our American publishers, they picked a little bit the political aspect to find an interesting title.
Gotcha. It's all about marketing, right?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. So, and in that, we talk a lot about flexion and bend then. What would you say is the difference between flexion and bend?
Flexion and bend, in my understanding, is pole flexion, lateral flexion of the pole, the very first tiny little symptom of starting to bend. If you follow the classical system, it is completely different to the bullfighting, western riding, gated horses riding. So the philosophy is built on the working philosophy. The full bend we are looking for is something you develop over years. It might take 4 to 5 years, and only if you are a rider who knows what he does, to get the maximum bend of the trunk so that you have the highest level, like von Steinbrecht, the highest level of collection, the high school collection. So if you have the maximum bend possible, you are on high school collection. And flexion is if you start to sort of bend the ribs behind the girth with your inside leg, the first reaction before you feel the bend in the trunk is the inside eye shows up, mm-hmm. the crest flips over, and your seat starts to get a tiny little deeper position on the inside. So this is, let's say, the first introduction towards bend.
Okay. And this comes after the pole flexion, yes?
Well, the pole flexion is the first step. It's the first symptom.
Okay.
And we have there are a few interesting points in this context. If you compare the different philosophies, a working cowhorse, for example, has to work many hours. So he would probably let his trunk sink a little bit behind the shoulder blades. This is why he would trot without suspension. He would try to pick up a very economical way to trot and to canter.
Mm-hmm.
A lope is much more economical than a nice uphill canter. But the advantage, this horse would not retire as quickly as from a cowboy standpoint, a dressage horse, a nice, beautiful dressage horse's movement is waste of energy. Because this horse is tired after 45, 50 minutes, mm-hmm. and his horse can last hours. So a completely different philosophy. And this is the biomechanics, these different positions in a different trunk position between the shoulder blades.
Mm-hmm.
We call it self-carriage. The horse comes up between the shoulder blades. And out of this, there is a steady contact possible. And the horses start to swing in the back. We want the high vertical swing in the back. A cowboy wants, in the ideal case, no swing, or maybe only a very little. He wants a calm back. And we want a high swing, but a soft, elastic swing, which we call suppleness. When the back is, you can sit the back, very soft and rhythmic, and you have a nice swing, like ballroom dancing, and the horse swings into your hands, you get the contact. It has nothing to do with pushing and squeezing.
Right, right. And the idea there, kind of, as you said, the difference between the dressage rider and the cowboy, a lot of that would just come down to the function, right, of what they're trying to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is, we come from different historical situations, I would say the war horse, the European horse, the war horse, was closer to the working cow horse, the cowboy horse, than to the dressage horse. But every horse, also the horses the officers picked in the military time and made high level dressage jumpers and so on out of them. These horses got their foundation, their basis, on a sort of, they build up a riding horse first. So I would say the 3 points in the training scale, rhythm, suppleness, contact, with a deeper neck, the nose forward, and the solid contact, and another difference to the cowboys, a straight horse first. In our philosophy, we would say if you read Steinbrecht or Potaisky or Dreihausen or Walz or whoever old master you read, they would say, never bend the neck more than you're able to bend the trunk. Another sentence says, we will not bend in the first year. So you want to have a straight horse first, and you would start to bend the horse in the ribs as soon as the horse takes both reins with soft chewing mouth, neck on withers level, horse and nose in front, and the horse is nice, rhythmically swinging, allows you to sit. Yeah, so this is our foundation we go for, the three points, the first points in the training scale. The cowboy would flex the horse's neck probably on the first day to get control, to get the shoulder off and so on. Mm-hmm. We would never do this, never.
Gotcha. I really like your analogy there between the generals and the standard mounted riders in the military and how that would be different. Because the soldiers basically are riding presumably much longer distances, needing to conserve that energy. So that makes sense that that would be kind of a flatter posture, if I could call it that, more energy conserving as they go.
Absolutely. You know, as soon as you get this soft round paw, the top line in the neck gets this nice convex top line, and you get a higher swing. As the back starts to swing a little bit more, of course the haunches swing forward. You get a longer swing in the haunches, and your horse starts to develop suspension, a higher spring effect. You need, and the horse allows you to drive. So this means you energize every single step. You would not just push in one and squeeze from behind forward. You would behave like a ballroom dancer in Vienna Ball, for example, who wants to sort of do longer steps. He would lengthen his contact, and you would, if you want to compare it with dancing, you would not push your dance partner forward. She might brace and fall. You would just swing her forward. This is the big difference. Today in sport, you see many people pushing horses.
Right.
And the reaction to the horse's reaction is they would brace, they would let the ribcage sink between the shoulder blades, the horses would curl in, the neck shortens, and you get into trouble with contact. You get the wrong understanding of contact, because people think contact is you hold 5 kilograms in each rein and push the horse into it. This is not contact. This has nothing to do with the contact.
Right. That's basically just pushing and pulling. I like the analogy that you used about the Viennese waltz. And that's something that I tell riders all the time in my own horsemanship clinics, that even when we get to kind of the highest degree of collection, we might be talking about the tango. And even in the tango, it's not pushing or pulling, but it's a more intimate connection.
Exactly. The highest collection leads to the lightest contact. And the more you ride forward, the more you get. If I may quote Paul Stecken, he died last year in the age of 100. He was Dr. Rainer and Ingrid Klimke's last teacher. And he always said, it's about something around half a pound to one pound of butter in your hands. The more you collect the horse, the less butter it is. And if you ride an extended canter, maybe it's in a big horse, it's 2 pounds of butter. The stride length, the longer the strides are, the suspension phase is, the more contact you have. And the shorter this suspension phase is, For example, in a Piaf, it's the rein weight or it's a loose rein for a second horse just on the seat. Yeah? So this is soft hands. You should have soft hands anyhow. And
right.
It's the lighter, the more you collect.
That makes perfect sense as we're drawing the center of gravity back more under the
exactly.
rider and to the haunches.
Exactly. The lumbar sacral joint flexes, seat bones sink, then it comes up, the pelvis stands a little more in a small angle, a little deeper, seat bones come down, and the horse is lighter in front.
Makes perfect sense. So the sympathetic hands that we talk about are the sympathetic reins, and the idea of holding a contact and the horse chewing softly on the bridle. I can't help but have brought to mind, of course, quite a bit of pulling that we see a lot now, and our over tightened nose bands and the flash nose bands. I can't help but wonder how much can the chewing actually happen with equipment used that way.
Well, we did some research. Where did the noseband come from? Maybe I start with a short explanation.
Perfect. Thank you. That was going to be one of my questions.
I have a good friend in Germany. He's a European cowboy, Pete Kreinberg. And he found the literature, some information that he said in middle ages when the knights rode heavy horses, and they went to war, their heavy horses were galloping, and suddenly the enemy shot, so cannonballs came against them. Of course, they had to stop, and if you do this emergency stop with a heavy horse without a noseband, they lost many horses because they damaged DMJ. They damaged, they got subluxation and they destroyed DMJ. The horse couldn't eat anymore, the horse was done. So they introduced the noseband to protect DMJ. So my comment to this is, in our modern indoor arenas, there's only very little shooting, even in America. So the noseband is not really necessary. The perfect classical contact is a communication between a soft hand and the muscle carrying the lower jaw. Of course, if you jump fences, if you're on a 3-4 fencing course, and in your situation, you need a little bit, let's say, an emergency stop, it's safer to give this lower jaw some support. A noseband has to give freedom to the lower jaw, because if the horse cannot chew, move the lower jaw, suppleness in the pole is not possible. If you crank it, if you really close it, you will never get the pole. This is a clear thing. You
right.
can have the nose down, but you will never get the soft pole. Never, ever.
Right, right. Well, and if they can't chew and they can't mobilize the tongue, then we're also negatively influencing the hyoid apparatus.
Yes, and from the hyoid, it has an articulation, a joint,
mm-hmm.
directly below the ear, the inner, where the bony canal is going into the skull, and there is a joint, and from the hyoid in the proximal part is a muscular connection to the processus paracondylaris, and from there to the atlas, so the first cervical spine. So you have a direct, you have a muscle chain from the hyoid into the short-headed neck muscles, which we call the pole, and the muscles around the pole. And if you have this chewing mouth, you get a reflectory relaxation in the pole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I know quite a few horses that I encounter, in order to fully release the hyoid and to release the TMJ, they go through yawning.
Yes, exactly.
And I've always wondered, I know now in the modern rules, for dressage, there's the two finger rule, with the adjustment for the nose band, but I don't think I've ever met a horse that could yawn with a nose band adjusted at two fingers.
So the old rule was two fingers upright above each other.
Upright, okay.
Standing on the nose. And today they made it, so the fingers are beside each other. I think.
Oh, wow, I didn't realize that.
Yes, they changed it. They didn't talk about it, but they changed it. And the old rule was two fingers above each other.
Mm-hmm.
When people ask me this, and they ask me, which nose band do you prefer? I have almost a standard answer. You know, women took over in the riding. And my answer is, I understand that you need a lot of beautiful looking pieces of leather and something, because the Swarovski stones have to go somewhere. So I would say, you can make your horse look like a Christmas tree as long as everything is loose.
Yes.
Everything has to be loose. The horse has to have freedom in front. Never influence lower jaw's mobility through any whatever thing you use on the horse's head.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah.
I find myself constantly adjusting nose bands in clinics and removing flashes and things like that. And most of it, I will definitely say, in support of most of the riders, most of them just don't know any different, because they're just doing what they've been told by their trainers, right?
Exactly.
And by so many higher level, I hate to admit it, but so many higher level clinicians.
Yes, sadly. You know, I think it came from the situation that if you compete and you don't have a good contact, but you compete and you need to use a little bit more contact to do your transitions, of course, if the noseband is correctly adjusted, the horse would open the mouth.
Yes.
This looks bad. And then they started to close the mouth mechanically. And the majority of people got used to it, but they don't know what they give away, because a horse cannot be supple without these qualities we described. If you don't have the ball, you don't get the back. If you don't have the back, you don't get the haunches. You cannot ride a classical horse with a locked mouth. It's impossible.
Right. So and this was a question that so many people have sent me, knowing that we were going to be talking about this. Given that now we have so much of this scientific information available, it's no longer theory, right? It's actual facts that we know about the horse's biomechanics, and we have it at our disposal. Anyone with a cell phone anymore can find it with a Google search or anything like that. What do you think are some of the limiting factors of basically that are getting in the way of change for competitive dressage in this way?
Well, so the question is, why do I think we run into these problems? Or did I get the question right?
Yeah, I think that's the gist of it. You know, now that we know so much, why is it still happening?
Okay, this is a very, very, very big question. I could talk 1 hour probably. Okay, let me start somehow, and you stop me if you have enough.
Okay.
I think we have several problems to the type of sport we have today. Number one, it's my private opinion, of course, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It's my opinion. I think number one is, in Germany, in the 60s, in the breeding world, things changed in the 60s, last century, 50 years ago. In the old days, the stallions were all national studs. Everybody in sport, everybody talked about the principle, nose in front of the vertical, the two fingers above each other, the loose nose, the capstan had to be loose, everything, we didn't have a flash, and so on and so on. So suddenly, big private farmers started by private stallion owner. The private stallion business started. And we And these guys started to present those stallions in competition. Started competing for, they just had the stallion that, and everybody did rely on the boss of this place to select the right stallion. Suddenly, a young stallion appeared. So this young guy, 3 years old, had to throw his legs. Some famous guys made a stallion show, and you see a three-year-old in a passage-like, totally-like trot on the diagonal. 3,000 breeders jumped and clapped their hands. And of course, use the stallion because they think this artistic, mechanized trot is the trot their foals will have 1 year later. So, the same stallion, 3,000 breeders jumped off the chairs, competes next weekend in a tiny riding horse test. So, there is a judge. This judge has the job to select a correctly trained, nice young horse. There's a very average gelding, solid three gates, neck down, nose forward, not very effectful, but correct. Everything nice, good-looking horse, but not very, nobody would jump off the chair because of this horse. This is correct horse, this would win. The next horse in the ring is our fancy young stallion from the last weekend. He won the stallion licensing. The judge knows that the breeder gave 400,000 euros for the stallion, and 3,000 breeders clapped their hands. So now he is in stress. He should ring the bell and should tell this guy on the stallion, go home, come back when your horse's neck is down, the nose is forward, and your horse trots and is not in a passage 10th step. But, of course, if he sends this guy home, he's in trouble because 150 of the breeders from the weekend stand around the ring. So there's a psychological pressure to the judge. And suddenly, this show trot came leading to the sport, and step by step to this, because more and more young stallions showed up, more and more show trot was presented in the sport. In the 70s, one guy, I know him in person, he doesn't live anymore, or knew him, showed up with a horse in a Grand Prix. He came from the circus, showed up in Grand Prix with a horse trotting like tortillas. He got a letter from our federation that we don't want to see this, and he should come back to the competition when his horse is in balance and trots correctly. 30 years, 40 years later, the whole world turns crazy when the black guy shows up and shows 10 steps and show trot in the World Equestrian Games, and they make it. So you see, a fashion or a trick to catch breeders for to get a mares for a stallion became fashionable. It looked sexy, and suddenly we have it like a virus all over the planet. So we lost our principles. We lost our principles. We had up to the 60s in the classic riding. In my apprenticeship, as a young guy, 1 week before my final test as a Bereiter in Germany, on Sunday I was on duty 1 week before my test. I thought nobody would see me. I took a young stallion in the German riding school. I was learning there and tried to exercise a little bit. And I did a very showy trot on the diagonal. I did not see that one of the old guys, his name was Donner, if you translate it, it's Thunder, Mr. Donner, would watch me behind the curtain. This guy had two amputated legs. He had two wooden legs. It took him maybe half a minute to come down from the first floor, standing in front of me and shouting, screaming, "We don't need a guy from Bavaria to destroy our young stallion. This is what we can do on our own." I had to dismount the horse now, and I had to clean the stud. The whole week long, I was not allowed to ride anymore up to my test because I made this mistake. So I did 10 steps. And he said, we can ruin our horses on our own. We don't need you to do this. So just to give you an idea, this was 1981. It was a question of honor not to do it. And suddenly the whole world clapped their hands in Germany 2006 in Martinet, and then later Totilas, and all these Dutch and German horses, and the Swedish and Danish whatever horses who come in flying front legs. We lost our culture. Yeah, it's so. It has nothing to do with classical dressage anymore. It's completely different. Yeah, and this is I think I clapped my hands also when I saw horses like this as a young man for the first time. Mm-hmm. But it takes some understanding and some knowledge about classical riding to understand why this would kill the horses. This right. destroys horses. Where are they? Yeah.
Right.
They get suspensory problems, back problems, pole problems. They are injected. They need a physiotherapy, osteopath, an acupuncture guy. They need an armada of therapists around them to stay alive. Mm-hmm. This cannot be classical dressage. This is bullshit.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, I believe you totally nailed it on the head, and I've seen it in other disciplines. It's come down to the flash and the excitement and, you know, what somebody thinks looks pretty or what might have won last weekend or whatever. And so then everyone kind of jumps on the bandwagon and they forget the horse in the process.
Exactly. HDV-12. This is a rule book from the German military out of our bad history from 1912. So the foundation of our federation's rule books. And this... HDV-12, there's many sentences in worth to quote, but one says, without suppleness, no further training makes sense. And if you ask, I would say, we have three generations of riders who, most of them, not everybody, but most of them don't know what suppleness is. If you ask them to describe this term, they would talk wrong stuff. They have no idea what it means. It was described first 1896 by Mr. Hollorfer, when he talked about the swinging back, the soft back, or swinging into soft hands with a nice long neck, or Egon von Neander, who says you want a soft contact with the ears as far away from you as possible. Mm-hmm. Or HDV-12, which says a warning of two round necks. You want a convex top line, but a wide convex top line. A short neck destroys the back. If you lose the back, you lose the horse. This is, yeah, you lose the back, the horse runs, the horse curls, the horse is irregular, the horse hangs on one rein, the horse is crooked, you cannot turn to the left, the horse would fall over the shoulder to the right, and so on, and so on, and so on. All these problems come from a wrong idea of balance, wrong idea of contact, and so on.
And I see so many riders, and I know you probably see this as much or more, that I don't know how else to put it, so I'll just go plain as it is, are just afraid of the horse's movement. And so they are restricting, and then the horse can't relax because he's being constricted in the movement the entire time. And we see this from the very first ride on some of these horses.
Exactly. They are started. They start the horse because so people who are afraid of this situation, riding a baby, mm-hmm. starting a baby, should not start a baby because they will hang on the reins.
Right.
If you cannot start a baby with a long neck, you brace the horse's back in the very first ride. And I know dressage people, especially dressage people who are frightened to put a little bit of grass under the horse's feet because they are afraid of a spooking horse.
Right.
These horses are under tension. They are ridden backwards from the very first day, and the average normal amateur rider has no chance to fix it. They are afraid to let the reins go. If you are a dressage rider, lower, medium, or higher level, and you cannot pick up the buckle between index finger and thumb and trot and canter in a half seat forward on a big pasture, you are not a dressage rider. You are just a stupid monkey.
I love that. And that's something that, you know, is such a struggle for riders. You know, it's as though they think the buckle lies somewhere in the middle of the rein or closer to the bit ring than it does the actual end of the rein.
Yeah. No, you let the reins go 100%. The reins are loose and you ride the horse in all three gates wherever you want to ride him. Then the horse, like a well-trained running a quarter horse, you must be able to ride the horse out of the seat.
Right.
Then you are able to ride the horse to the bit later when you offer a contact. But when the horse hangs on the reins, and as soon as you give the reins, the horse will run away. This is not contact.
Right.
This is slavery.
Right. Right. And subjugation instead of education.
Dangerous for the rider and slavery for the horse. This is not. This is, has nothing to do with dressage.
Right. Right. And it's interesting because I've heard some other fairly popular dressage clinicians that I will not name, but I've heard the comment, never let a young horse out on the rein because of how dangerous that is. And I can't help but think, God, how dangerous that horse is going to be into his teens if you don't let him out there and let him learn to own his own emotions.
I think those people's foals are born with side reins.
I think you're probably right. Or they get them at birth. Yeah.
Yes, they get them as the egg meets the sperm, and they are side reins in it already. And those foals spend the first 3 years with side reins on the pasture, probably.
Well, no, we wouldn't put them out into the pasture too much because they might slip and get hurt.
It's not so healthy because they might run. Yeah.
Right. Oh, no, I think you and I could get in trouble.
I don't care at all.
Right? It's a good thing this is my broadcast, right? People can complain all they want. We're having fun.
Yes, of course.
Well, and you know, we joke about it, but it's nothing short of a damn shame, you know?
It's so sad. You know, I give you the definition of dressage in the old rule books. The meaning of dressage is the highest level of control over a horse outside cross country with soft aids in any situation. You know, a pregnant cow can jump 3 feet. Why should the dressage horse not be able to do this? Any dressage horse right. should be able to do a little jump, to jump a little fence, a ditch, whatever. Yeah?
Right.
So,
right.
On the Olympics 1912, these were the first Olympics with horses in the new time. Do you know what the dressage horses had to do when they finished the dressage test?
Did they not have to jump the rolling barrel? Was that still in there?
Exactly. They had to jump the rolling oil barrel, a barrel rolling towards them.
Yeah.
I would love to bring it back. I think dressage would die out tomorrow.
Or a lot of the riders would probably die anyway. That would be
yes, that would be
traumatic for sure. But so necessary. There's so much of that you know, if they were to bring that back, it would require emotional control of the horse. Which, and get me wrong, but I include this as part of our suppleness, because if they don't have emotional control, they're going to be contracting in the back just out of a fear response.
Exactly, and they are dangerous. But we should mention also, we have a few guys who still do it. Mm-hmm. I saw it with my own eyes. Ingrid Klimke, mm-hmm. I don't know if you know her. She's eventing and she rides dressage and show jumps. I saw her on a young stallion, I think 7 or 8 years old, finishing. I think it was a fourth level dressage test. So maybe I1, something like this.
Okay.
She finished the test, and then she gave the reins. Six people came in. Two people had a rail bar. And they formed a high oxer, maybe 4 or 5 feet high. She took the reins again, half seat, and jumped a third, fourth level jump after the dressage test in
That's
front
fantastic.
Of the dressage auditors. So this is dressage, yeah?
Yes.
Pick up the reins and turn them. And have a horse, a dressage horse must first be a riding horse.
Right.
If a dressage horse is useless for anything else, so you cannot even cross a meadow, you cannot, some Olympic winners, it takes five people to transport the horse from the box, from the stall to the training area.
Mm-hmm.
And what is this? What is this? You need a horse you can let the reins drop and walk out the tent and walk to the warm-up area. Why not?
Right.
Why is this? Why should this be dangerous? You have a fully gymnasticized, nice, soft horse. This is what you want, a horse you can use to take the reins and have a happy hack in the forest.
Well, and we should be able to expect that from a horse in its first months under saddle. They can certainly handle it mentally if we prepare them the right way, if we present it right to our horses, and yet there are so many that struggle for years.
Guess why the classical training system says in the first year of training, the horse should spend more than two-thirds of the time on the saddle outside hacking. Guess why the military took the young horses to long distance rides? They wouldn't care if it's a new show jumper or a dressage horse or maybe a horse for the military. Every single horse had to become a horse first. They called this remont years, the first 2 years of basic training. They had to become a riding horse first. You can stop, give the reins, and take a phone call or dismount the horse, fix something, mount the horse again, and go on.
Right.
A horse you can use, and not a horse which is dangerous to go somewhere, and they blame it to be the new breed and the special horses and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's the way we treat them and not the way how they are. A horse is a horse, still a horse. Yeah.
Right. Right. And, sometimes I think maybe I'm coming from a different planet or something. I was very fortunate to ride and live a little while with the master Western horseman, Ray Hunt. And I don't know if that's a name that you know.
Of course.
But Ray had a pretty simple philosophy with the young horses that we rode, and they almost all lived up to the philosophy that day one, they cost you money. Day two, they hold their own. And day three, they're on the payroll. Basically what he meant was that by day three, you could go out and work the ranch, even in a basic way, check fences or whatever. By the third ride, you should be able to get out there and ride those horses and get along and earn a little bit of a living on them. And now they weren't expected to be high level dressage horses or anything like that. But for the most part, they owned their own emotions. You know, within the first three rides, they owned their own emotions. And if they didn't, you could help them with very, very little effort. And so when I start a lot of dressage horses under saddle, it feels sometimes like walking on water because these horses are able to be ridden. And within the first three rides, they're the quietest, most broke horses in the barn. And then the progression is so much simpler because we've allowed the horses to own their emotions from the very beginning instead of the cranking and the holding and the pulling and the spanking and the pushing and the strapping them together and all that other garbage.
I sign this 100%. And this is why we should not spend the first time with the baby in the indoor or outdoor arena.
Right.
This is also a recommendation from the old days. A young horse needs a wide open room because in our world, the more suspension, the bigger the gates are, the more you have to be careful not to bend at the beginning. So avoid corners. So keep this horse in wide lines. Don't pull the neck to the inside. It's easy if you have a horse with a small trot, they wouldn't care. But
right.
If you do this, you brace the back and the flexion and bend is high school and university, and rhythmic forward is kindergarten and the basic school. Yeah. First, make the horse a horse. Wide lines, hack out. We started babies outside. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't hang on the reins, this is no problem.
Right. Right. Well,
yeah.
Damn it, Garrett, we've got a show to go to. I need to start off in the middle of that pyramid. I can't spend my time at the bottom.
Yeah. Exactly. It is the same as if you take your six-year-old boy or brother and send him to university. The poor child cannot make it.
Right.
Go step by step. Let a young horse be a young horse. A three-year-old is not a dressage horse or a jumper or even eventer. It is a baby. It's a young horse. And we start him, and we want to make him a riding horse in the first 1.5, 2 years. Mm-hmm. When he's a riding horse, then we pick the discipline, and we make him maybe a young dressage horse. Mm-hmm. But he has a foundation. You can use him for anything, and it's a riding horse. And this is what we don't respect today.
Right. Right. Well, and even the idea of developing the muscles to carry a rider and developing the proper proprioception carrying the rider, they would need to get out on the varied terrain, yes?
Of course. This, and they need the neck, because it's the only arm of a lever helping the horse to find the balance with the additional weight on the back. So you would not take the neck away either downwards nor upwards. So any artificial neck position is wrong. It's not just the Rolko or the hyperflexion. The horse, I love Felix Birkner's comment. He says, the young horse shows you where it wants to put the neck first.
Yes.
And then give him a soft contact, let him go. And from this sort of baseline, you would start a nice stretch and later the nice relative rising of the forehand. Why should we pull the head down or up? Just leave him alone and let him make his own decision where he wants to carry his neck.
Right, right. Well, it's just like young children, you know. They go to a tumbling class before they start gymnastics.
That's it.
They have to learn to use their body the way they feel natural before you can manipulate that and educate it further.
Yes, let them climb a tree first.
Right, right. That's fantastic. We could definitely go on quite a bit from here. I want to run through some of my notes here. And this is maybe a question that, I don't know, could probably spend us another 2 hours conversation. But I've had this sent to me. I do frequent question and answer videos on our Facebook page, and one that was presented to me that I've saved for this conversation specifically comes from a gal who asks that, she says she's struggling to align herself with dressage as a discipline because of all the yanking, cranking, jabbing, and kicking that she sees in spite of what she's reading, practicing, and knowing to be true of classical dressage, you know, entailing lightness, relaxation, harmony. So how does she go about that? And her question really is it time for some sort of delineation between classical and modern dressage?
The first guy who wrote in his book, classical dressage based on the old masters and competition dressage will not go together, was Oscar Maria Steinsbeck. He published 1931. Because he says, I give his words some interpretation. He says, in a young horse, you cannot do a perfect soft half hold at C or at A 5 times on one weekend without pulling. In a completely trained horse on the highest level, you can do the half hold whenever you want and how often you want. But in a young horse, he probably might braze a little bit at sea, and at home you would just pass the corner and you would do your half hold, let's say 30, 50 feet later, and then you get a soft half hold. So in competition, you don't have this option, so you have to. Mm-hmm. Finally, you have to pull. And if you start to pull on the competition, suddenly you have to pull at home. And so the whole mechanizing horses starts. You hang on the reins. My dream is that we get classical dressage back to the competition. Mm-hmm. But we have to change, in my eyes, we have to change young horse classes. I give you my ideas. They might be wrong, but it's my private opinion. I think a three-year-old horse, a warm-blood horse, has nothing, should not show up in a competition anyhow. Of course, I know a breeder who has to sell his horses, he needs this platform. Mm-hmm. So this is the only reason we should be a little bit flexible. So we could say probably, okay, you can show your three-year-old horse three times a year. But then this three-year-old horse should not show up as a potential dressage horse, should not show up in an arena. This horse should show up between the fences in the course, in the jumping concours, walk, trot, canter between the fences. Mm-hmm. And the rider should have eventing saddles for stirrups, and he should not give the feel that this is a dressage horse. The judge should take a microphone and tell the rider, please show us some trot around this nice oxen on the right rein. Mm-hmm. And then give the reins down to the buckle, take the reins again, a soft half hold over 3-4 steps to walk, give the reins again. Pick up a canter right lead, blah, blah, blah. So the judge tells the rider what he wants to see, and the judge gives a mark for this young horse and its potential for future dressage horse. So this could be a baby dressage test for a three-year-old.
So that's more about evaluation and experience for the young horse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah, I don't want to see a young horse be chased into a corner. This horse cannot bend the ribs.
Right.
So the rider has to hang on the reins, more or less. And so we should make young horse classes, especially for the 3 and the 4 year olds, maybe a little bit even for the 5 year olds, but 3 and 4 with a half hold, for example, from trot to walk. Should happen about at sea, so maybe 15 feet before and 15 feet after. So there is an area where the rider can do his transition. We should not ask for a half hold on the spot. We should allow some steps in between when the rider slows down from canter to trot. So why not letting this horse a little bit fall into trot, and not, the rider should not have to pull on the reins.
Right.
I just picked some pictures. Yeah. So people should sit together and say, okay, we change our young horse classes. So then finally at the end of the 4th year, the 4 year old on the way to 5 would be a soft horse in a soft contact who can change 3 gates, walk, trot, canter with soft transitions. Mm-hmm. This should be our goal people who take care for the right exercises and so on. You know what I want to say? I'm missing the words now. So people who care for the who make this how do you call this little dressage test? Who make the tests?
These people.
So these people should try to adjust it more to the young horse.
Yeah.
This is my first concern. And then suppleness should be a must to any horse from 5 years upwards.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a clear definition, a soft seat, a swinging back. If you see somebody from 5, 6, 7, of course in the young years, it doesn't exist because they pick up a light seat and maybe they post the trot or whatever. But as soon as they sit the trot and somebody is bouncing around, they should ring the bell.
Mm.
Yeah. A bouncing stiff rider.
There you go.
Means positive, two stiff riders, stiff horse.
Right.
Nothing to do with dressage.
Right.
Send them out.
Right. There's no room for suppleness if you're both stiff.
No. You know, every step forward without suppleness doesn't make sense. This would be active animal protection. So a bouncing rider is out. That's it.
That makes good sense.
And if somebody has a soft, nice, harmonious seat, swinging into the horse's motion, he's welcome. And he's ready to win.
Mm-hmm.
And bring back the quality to our tests, the real quality. And of course, we need judges who see it.
Right.
So they should not count the one-time changes and check if they are straight. They should look if these changes over the back if it's soft change out of the seat. Yeah, and if the horse is in balance, and not count it and look if it's straight or half pass, all lateral movements. We ride a lateral movement. Steinbrecht calls it bending on two tracks. It is not a medium trot with 10 steps with a neck pulled to the inside.
Mm-hmm.
A half pass is a collected exercise and not a passage, whatever, right, with a broken neck in front and a stiff trunk. So, you know, bring the quality back to our tests and ring the bell if you see a wrong one.
Right.
And then the whole world would be clear if we had classical riding after 2 years.
Well, and I'm even thinking about how the industry would change as far as the riders that we have that really don't ever progress because of fear in themselves and anxiety and lack of control in the horses. Those things would be practically non-existent if we
Exactly.
were talking about rewarding the suppleness within the first couple of years.
Exactly. If you take the bouncing stiff horses out,
mm-hmm.
Fear would go away because a soft horse is a horse under control.
Right.
If a horse's body is soft, his mind is soft. If a horse's body is stiff, it's a flight animal, the horse is ready to spook, to rear,
right,
to whatever, to dangerous things.
Right.
So suppleness is the guarantee that the horse is under control, soft, balanced, in harmony.
Right. Right. Well, I guess there's a reason why rhythm and relaxation are at the base of that triangle we all talk about.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm probably guilty of saying it too much, but I tell riders constantly, you cannot out-muscle an emotion.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You cannot fix a mentally difficult horse by treating his mind. You have to unlock his physics, his body. When the horse is soft in the body, his mind will be okay. You can treat his mind to the end of the day. You can ask him to lie down on the couch and tell him wise things as a psychologist for horses. You will never get the horse. You will never get the horse's back. When the horse's back is stiff, his mind is locked up.
Right, right. And so he's not even in a position of learning at that point because his brain is in the wrong state.
Absolutely. He's in clubs. He's a flight animal.
Right, right. Oh gosh. Okay. So, and yet we see so much of this going on. So I'm going to bring up. I had sent you before we started our call something that got quite a bit of attention recently from the USDF Connection magazine. They have on the cover of the magazine. The magazine's articles listed are talking about the proper contact and the anatomy of the horse's neck and so on and so forth, and it sounds like a fantastic issue. And I sent you the photo of the horse that they've got used on the cover there, and it's pretty obvious that there are some things that even go against the rule book as far as the even just simply the adjustment of the bridle. They've got one of those little foam, or two little foam inserts at the chin strap and at the noseband that are obviously compressed and sticking up and things like that from being overly tightened. There was quite a bit of discussion, if we want to call it that, when they posted a photo of that here on Facebook. I'm so curious to get your thoughts about that.
Well, I had a quick look at this photo, and I only can say this has nothing to do with the contact. This is a horse held in front and pushed into it.
Mm-hmm.
A contact, look at the horse's face, his eye. The nose is in front of the vertical, yeah? This is the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see all these muscles tense. This is not a horse reaching to the bit. This is a horse forced into something.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, maybe we have pictures even worse, but this horse is not a confident horse. I love Steinbrecht's sentence, which is Steinbrecht is, I would say, late 19th century, mm-hmm. the foundation of our classical riding worldwide. And he says, the horse has to fall in love with your hand. Well, this does not look like a very big love.
I love that thought, though, that line, the horse has to fall in love with your hands.
Yes, this is what Shabrai said, the horse has to fall in love with your hands. So you offer something and the horse goes and you get a soft communication. Yes, and some people mix it up. Yeah, they bring me a horse running with 20 pounds in each hand. And in the correction world, sometimes you have to tell them, no, you stay here. And if you take a photo at this moment, of course, you get a photo like this. But the final result, doing when you correct the horse or a horse in a correct training, you should have a relaxed horse, a horse to the bit, a soft horse, a horse who you should, in a photo, you don't see the chewing, but you see confidence in the mouth. Mm-hmm. And when you look at his lips, they look like if somebody pulls on those lips 1 hour every day, you can see it, that is not a correct contact.
Right, right. And it's pretty obvious that the flash is the only reason why they're not, or the nose band adjustment is the only reason why they're not opening the mouth in that photo.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I can't help but question then, when the photo was discussed, when it was published and folks were up in arms about it, it was a photo taken from a show. So how does equipment adjusted that way, you know, not even to take into account the rider's obviously unsympathetic hands in that moment, right? I'm not saying she's an unsympathetic rider. I don't know her. But in that moment, right, how would equipment like that even make it into the show arena?
We got used to it. This is our problem, yeah? We got used to it. In Germany, they try to change the rules, and they talk about these two-finger rules now. You mentioned it before. And the old two-finger rules was two-finger above each other. So two up, can I say upright? So
yeah.
Index finger, yeah. Middle finger above each other, not lying on the nose, but sort of standing on the nose.
So stacked together instead of side by side.
Exactly, above each other. So on the nose upwards. This was the old two-finger rule, mm-hmm. and they changed it to lying fingers. Of course, this is a compromise, but even not a good one. So they should move back to the two fingers vertical. Mm-hmm. And this would allow the horse to mobilize the lower jaw. And then when a rider has to give a little bit of more clear half hold in the test, and the horse opens the mouth, this is something this can happen to any rider then, because every rider has the same situation. And the judge can give a certain comment to this. Mm-hmm. But closing the mouth with a piece of leather so that the horse cannot open the mouth is just taking, well, a judge should see it anyhow, how stiff a horse is, but it takes away one symptom, one quality a judge could evaluate as a good contact or less good contact. So I would say the only answer to this is old two-finger roll, two-finger upright, loosen the noseband, and then you will see if the horse is in good contact or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So where would you say the responsibility ultimately falls for this? I mean, we can say the trainers, we can say the judges, we can say the tack checkers and all of that stuff.
The judges are, if I use the German word, they are the executives. They just put the rules into action.
Yes.
So, but the federations make the rules,
mm-hmm.
and it's the federations' job to fix it. First, of course, FEI, and then the federation, and I think the second biggest is the American Federation.
Mm-hmm.
If the two biggest federations would step back to the old traditional rules, I think the whole world had to change. And we were a step closer towards classical riding again.
That makes sense. I mean, and something that I run into, maybe I have ideas on where I think blame ought to go, but we have so many judges, and I see this in other disciplines. I don't talk so much to the dressage judges necessarily about this, I just haven't had those conversations yet.
Yeah.
But you know, they say, well, we can't disqualify them, because then we would be disqualifying everyone and we wouldn't be hired back to judge.
Yeah, so this is a problem, of course.
Yes.
In Germany, a federation started some trainer travel around in Germany, and they offer, it's called Besser Reiten. So,
okay.
And and they try to talk about the right things, and it's absolutely correct what these people say, mm-hmm. and what they try to present there. But finally, everything you mentioned in the competition is still accepted. So what they do now, they try to be a little bit pregnant, you know?
Yeah, right.
They talk a little bit nice things, but finally, because they don't want to step on anybody's feet, mm-hmm. and they don't want to get in trouble with the judges, and they don't want to get in trouble with the famous riders, so they sort of accept it. On the other hand, I think we only can change it if the federation says, okay, 1st of January 2018, all I judges, all official judges, come to, I don't know, wherever, Swiss, Lausanne, FEI location, and they get the new rules. From now on, we don't want to see one single stiff horse with cranking, pushing, bleeding anyhow, yeah, all these things. We mm-hmm. don't want to see this anymore. If you see this, ring the bell, send him home.
Right.
I think in 1 year, we had a new sport. Because we have so many talented riders. We have beautiful riders. They could do it in a different way.
Right.
But they want to win.
Beautiful riders and more talented horses than ever in history.
And I think also more talented riders ever.
Sure.
Because I think they never had so many people with beautiful seats and everything nice.
Right.
So why... I think we could have the nicest, most beautiful sport, not only in dressage, maybe the same in reining and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I hear from your colleagues and some people I know that they run the horses into walls at night to prepare the sliding stock. So what is this? Or they tie horses shanks to the horse's hind leg overnight.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? So why should we do things like this?
Right.
Our life is not depending on it. I can't understand if somebody in wartime on horseback did some bad stuff because his life was depending on it, whatever. But today, it's most people's hobby. They love their horse.
Right.
Why should they do it? I don't understand it.
And it seems to me, and again, I'm just one guy out there doing my thing, but it seems to me that a lot of it comes down to egos, bullshit, and paychecks.
Exactly. Yeah. It's ego. Ego is a very big thing.
Yeah.
Ego, and finally, it's money and the feel. I want to be one of the business. I want to be in it. And, you know, so, yeah, it's all this.
Oh, goodness. So... right now, as it stands, who's winning? I know that's a hard question, and I'm sorry to ask that one, but how do you feel about that? Because I feel there are so much more, like we talked about earlier, there's so much more scientific fact out there now, rather than opinion, that's available to us. And we're not just in the information age, we're in the free information age, so there's no excuse to be a dumbass, you know? There's no such thing as I didn't know or I didn't have the opportunity to know. But yet we still see it happening. So what needs to happen? What do we need to do?
I run around on this planet since almost 20 years now with this message. And you can imagine that half of the planet hates me and the other half thinks I do a good job. And
right.
I finally felt that maybe I made a mistake because I sort of divided the society, the equine society, into half. and a good one, and this is wrong. Some people say you had to do this, otherwise they would not have listened to you. But I'm a little bit sad about the fact that all these people who hate me, I think I don't want to criticize them as a person.
Right.
I would love to get these people slowly to the other side. It's not about criticism. I did hang on horses' reins on my own, and I made many mistakes on my own. So I'm
sure,
not
as we all
than,
have, yeah.
You understand? I'm not better than anybody else out there. So, but I think I realize that we should change something. Otherwise, maybe this wonderful, if you want to call it sport, some call it art and dressage, will die out one day. Because, of course, animal welfare people cannot accept this in the long term, that we do some people do really strange things to horses, and this is not we cannot accept it.
Right.
And why should riding be abused? Classical riding is not abuse, it is active animal protection, it's harmony. And a horse would not die if you kick, sorry for this term, kick his ass once or twice and tell him, hey, listen. So it's a big animal, but the outcome must be harmony, softness, a nice, fair companionship, and not making one animal be a slave and the other guy sits on and smiles and gets a ribbon.
Right. Well, I love the way that Charles de Cunfee words it. He says that, I've heard him say it in clinics, that proper riding is therapeutic to the horse, not detrimental.
Exactly. That's it.
Yeah.
And what we see today, he calls it cockroach dressage.
Yes, right.
Yeah, because the top line of the horse is like in a cockroach. It would not change. Yeah, they ride in with the same rein length as they come back. So they would not give the reins once beside they walk.
Yes, right, right. Oh, yeah. My gosh. It's funny, but it's terrible at the same time. Goodness.
Yes.
So I've got a bunch of questions coming in from our listening audience. Do you mind if we field some of those questions?
Okay.
Okay, great. Let's see. I'm going to try to scroll here. So I apologize if there's anyone on here that I've missed. But Dawn has a question. She asks, what would be a good strategy to help an ex-racehorse learn to find relaxation at the canter under saddle? As we know, forward is always good medicine for helping a horse, but I find the racehorse forward comes with a mindless forward way of going, and she likes her horse to be with her in mind and body.
Okay, of course there are situations, and I saw horses, the system I would recommend her would not work. Mm-hmm. There are exceptions. Mm-hmm. But the majority of the horse would react positively if you, for example, would start, you warm your horse up and walk with a long rein. And then I learned this from Manolo Mendez years ago. He says, go into a light seat and trot on, rein on the buckle. So try, stay in a safe in the arena, trot on with the rein on the buckle. Trot this horse so that the horse's neck goes down, the neck falls in front of the withers, and the horse is completely relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
If you get this stage, start to send the horse a little bit on the long side and slow the horse down on the short side just by relaxation. So when the horse's neck is down and you can send him a little bit, then try light seat, half seat, a few steps of canter. The horse runs, slow him down again, pick up the reins, slow him down again, give the reins, and every good racehorse would slow down as soon as you give the reins.
Mm-hmm.
And if a jockey wants to speed up, he would pull on the reins.
Right.
So just teach the horse to trot and later canter. Safety is first. Always safety first, of course, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So if sometimes you have a dangerous horse, you know, and I don't want to recommend to canter on a loose rein when the horse is really dangerous.
Right.
Then you should ask a professional who knows this work. But I think most of the horses would be, you could canter them in a nice, relaxed canter with rein on the buckle.
Over so a series of rides, of course.
And in between, do some slow walk work, a little bit leg yield, and some nice walk work so that the horse's neck goes down, the nose comes forward, the horse starts to chew. A proof, if you do the right stuff, is the chewing. When the horse starts to chew, you have the right tempo and you see this often enough. So this would be my approach.
Perfect. Well, and that brings us right into a good segue, I think, into our next question from Kimberly. And Kimberly says she audited your clinic in North Carolina recently, and you had a great explanation of riding to the loose rein to achieve straightness. Can you please share the mechanics and reasoning of that again?
Yeah, so I think most horse people know every horse has, as we call it, a natural crookedness, so a handedness, laterality. A human being is right-handed or left-handed, so is a horse. And this natural crookedness leads, if you pick up the reins, to an uneven contact. So one rein is heavier and the other rein is loose. And many people try to straighten the horse by pulling on the heavy rein.
Right.
And with the idea to soften. And the classical idea and the classical system is not fighting stiffness, but accepting the horse's neck position, head position, offering a soft contact. And I quote HDV 12, it's translated to English, ride to the loose and give on the heavy. So your brain has to step away from this idea. My most warm bloods are stiff on the left side, so 60% stiff to the left side, 30-40% stiff to the right side. So give on the heavy. If your hand is forward, the hand is not pulling the horse, you would not try to pull the neck to the inside. You would probably accept a little bit counterflexion. You would give on the heavy and ride to the loose. You are in a forward, straightforward feel. And this causes a contact over the weeks and months to both reins. The bit is symmetrical in the horse's mouth. And then when the horse, when you can change tempo, when you can change gates, when you can ride the horse into the contact, then you start to bend on one track, on a serpentine with the inside leg, and you will get the first flexion and maybe the tiny first little bend. But first we need a straight horse in our world.
So giving on the rein that the horse is heaviest in, and that, to me, that makes so much sense. And it's something, interestingly enough, that I've been experimenting with the last couple thousand horses that I've been teaching. And it seems to me that that fits very well with the horse's neurology, because if they're, say, they're bracing on the left rein and you pull on that, they're going to be bracing in the hindquarters as well. And then you're exactly starting that whole idea of a braced longissimus and everything else in there. So the release gives him basically nothing to resist against.
You only can soften any muscle by giving and not by pulling. It's impossible. You cannot get softness by acting backwards against the stiffness. It's impossible.
I'm writing that down because I love that idea. You can only soften any muscle by giving, not by pulling.
Contact, my subtitle for contact is the art of giving. You have to learn your and how much and the timing. The timing of the moment you give is the most important thing. I just have a lady here in the clinic. She had big trouble. Her pony was nose high and against her hands, completely defensive. Today, 45 minutes, horse in balance, round, nice. The neck dropped to withers level, soft contact, incredible. This horse, this woman learned to give, and the horse is in balance. It's so fun to see this.
Isn't it interesting? Rather counterintuitive, I think, for most of us as humans. We want to clutch until the horse learns to yield, but it's counter to their instincts to do that.
Hello?
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, we are. Yeah, okay. Now I hear you.
Okay, perfect.
Absolutely.
Good. Great. Another question comes in from Nina. And Nina asks, how do you get the maximum top line development, particularly when doing hill work or other trail work?
Bringing the top line in action. So, I quote Egon von Neindorf again. Get the ears as far away from you as possible with a soft pole. So, the longer this top line is, the more positive tension is in these muscles, and the more the back the top line, the back, the croup would work, and the top line will develop in a rhythmic forward.
Makes
so only
sense.
a muscle in a nice long top line can develop.
Makes
Can
perfect
you hear
sense.
me?
He's got to be reaching out and activating that in order for it to happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Horse to the bit, not bit to the horse.
There we go. Yeah, there you go. Yes. Horse to the bit and not bit to the horse. And you mentioned earlier in one of the topics that we were touching on, bringing the horse to the bit instead of, well, you didn't say instead of, but my mind went instead of putting the horse on the bit.
Exactly. So you would not take the bit and pull backwards and
right.
push against it. You would create an offer, a soft offer, and the rhythmic driving. As soon as the horse finds rhythm and trot, in our world, trot is the most important gait. A cowboy probably would work more in walk and in canter, and a trot is maybe less important. For us, trot is the most important gait,
mm-hmm.
because there we build up the rhythm, the swing, the suppleness, and we transport it into canter. And finally, of course, walk at the beginning, you would just walk on the longer rein. You would not touch in the baby the reins too much.
Mm-hmm.
But trot, finding rhythm in trot is the entrance door to heaven. If you, it's the old definition. Do I have time to talk about this?
Absolutely.
The old definition of rhythm is that every step is the same long and the same fast or slow. So they say every step looks the same, but the old definition does not talk about how fast, because a very fast same steps would be rhythmic in the old definition, and also super slow would be rhythm then. And if they are still the same long and the same slow, and they didn't ask in the old definition how fast. And I think this is the most important question. You have to find the perfect tempo which allows you as a rider to sit down, exhale, close your eyes, and drop your mind. Yeah?
Mm.
Sit down and listen to the horse. And then when the horse would not run away from your seat, would not stay behind you and be slow, but stay with you and swing with you, then you can start to drive. You can pick up to underline this sinus curve a little bit and swing into it, and suddenly the horse would step under further and would pick up, would take the bit, pick up a contact, would start to chew, the pole would round, the horse would stretch the top line, and suddenly you get a chewing soft contact. So finding rhythm, in my eyes, is the entrance to a driven.
Yes. And that has to come with the horse's relaxation.
Yes, it goes hand in hand.
Yeah. So the horse's own natural tempo, wherever he finds that he owns the
exactly.
tempo. So I talk a lot about tempo being an emotional condition of the gait. Because if the horse is emotional, they're going to be more erratic in their tempo. They're not going to find that steady rhythm that, like you said, that you can just kind of sit and close your eyes and know that the horse is going to be there with you.
You say emotional, or the horse is just stiff and running,
right?
Because it's a flight animal, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in these horses, you as an experienced rider, you have to find the perfect tempo so you can lock in with your seat. Your spine has a vertical swing, the horse's spine has a horizontal swing,
mm-hmm.
and in the ideal case, you bring the two waves together, and suddenly you sort of swing together like a ballroom dancer in a Vienna waltz.
Yes.
And then you can swing the horse into a contact. And if you sit on a horse, bouncing and pushing and squeezing, you will never get this. Never, ever.
Right. Right. Oh, I love it. All right. So a question comes in from Linda. You mentioned a similarity between the cowboy's horse and a war horse. Knowing that the good cavalry horse was developed with somewhat classical principles, do you feel that the new discipline of Western dressage, which has recently come onto the scene, has the potential to bring forward essential classical principles that are now missing in competitive dressage?
My clear answer is yes, of course. There is a big potential. But I remember a few years ago, I know the guy very well who came up with this idea of Western dressage,
mm-hmm.
or at least he's the one in charge of organizing this.
Yes.
And I asked him, Do you want a dressage horse or a western horse? Do you want the ribcage down or up? Do you want suspension and rhythm? Or do you want a horse with a deep back, closer to a jog, a little bit flatter, less rhythmic? So I think there are a few questions open, still open. We have to ask ourselves, which horse do we want to have?
Mm-hmm.
I guess we are in America, more the cowboy horse. And then the question is, do I want to ride this horse in a steady contact, or do you want to ride the horse in an impulse system with a loose rein, soft impulse to the nose or mouth, loose rein, soft impulse, loose rein? So there are, in my understanding, there are still a few open questions, but if this system, this new discipline would be built on classical ideas, this potential to bring back the classical idea. Oh, absolutely. Because in this discipline, probably at the moment, nobody would accept a horse cranked together and put into
right.
tension to do some fancy steps.
Right.
And this is why there's still a lot of potential inside. Hopefully, they don't turn to the wrong roads.
Right.
Yeah?
Exactly. And I have quite a few students that compete in Western dressage at the schooling shows, because right now that's where most of the Western dressage is being exhibited, is at the schooling shows. But it's really interesting to see that a lot of the Western dressage horses are coming away with the high point awards from the shows. It's very interesting to see. It's very interesting. So, fantastic. Allah wants to know, how much can I expect a 15-year-old and a 20-year-old horse to change their way of going? For example, can a 15-year-old quarter horse stop stabbing the ground and start floating, or am I dreaming?
Well, first of all, I think we have 20-year-old horses who are young, maybe not young, but who are still athletic horses,
mm-hmm.
and we have 30-year-old horses who are old. So it is you cannot connect it with age. In Charlotte area where I met the other lady, I had a 27-year-old warm blood. He looked fresh. If this lady would have told me he's 12, I would have believed. So really beautiful horse. Of course, when the horse is healthy, healthy legs, good looking, and not a very bad experience, he is ready to do everything. And if the horse is 20 years old and there are some issues already, some joints don't look very well anymore, the back is a little bit stiff, the pole is a little bit stiff, then I would say, do not try to change him a lot, because you would not take your 80-year-old grandfather,
right.
He who spent his life in the office, to make a long-distance runner. So,
right, it just wouldn't be fair to the body.
This would not be fair to the horse. This is just unfair. But if a good horseman knows this is a healthy horse, still fit, and then, of course, try a little bit, and you see if he complains, and he's older, 17, 18, 19, 20, then leave him alone, and he is happy. And
mm-hmm.
you don't change. This was a mistake I made sometimes when I was younger. I tried to get every horse back up. Yeah, and
right.
So the back in a self-care position, and I think I did some mistakes, and I didn't treat every horse well. So I wouldn't do this now anymore. I learned from this.
Gotcha. Some of them you just have to leave alone. And now, and as I understand it, there is an age at which we can no longer really change the muscles, but we can certainly help them to relax. Yeah.
I think an older horse, 20 plus, if you just keep him mobile,
mm-hmm.
to go, and in an older horse, I would listen more. What is his tempo he likes the best? And I would adjust a little bit more to the horse.
Yes.
As we would behave on a baby, you would also adjust to the horse. And in an older horse, don't put too much pressure and too much ideology to an older horse. I think he
yeah.
must help.
I love that idea. We would be adjusting to the horse. And that's something that Ray Hunt used to say to us all the time, was that he was adjusting to fit every horse. He says, and I found that to work every time, because if I found a horse it wasn't working with, I would just adjust to him anyway.
We have internet problems, I think.
Uh-oh. Can you hear me? It seems we've got a little bit of a sketchy connection.
Yes, but I move my I go somewhere else. Maybe it's better here.
Oh, that sounds much better. Yep. Good. Perfect. Okay. Let's see. So it looks like I actually lost a few of our questions there streaming through. We've had a lot of folks sending in comments and things like that. And that's so fantastic, gang, for our listeners. I really love having your action here as part of this discussion. This has been so much fun. One more thing I would like to bring up, and I'd just like to get more or less your opinion on this. And then we can, I suppose we can sort of wrap up, unless we get on another tangent, which is fine with me too. But we see in some of our Western horses, and I'm kind of going back to the roll cur idea and the hyperflexion idea, we see in some of our Western horses and some disciplines and some training ideas, certainly more than others, but we see these horses that are backing off of the bridle, essentially coming behind the bit or behind the hand, even with a slack rein. And so they're not necessarily in those postures being pulled, but it's something that I've kind of started calling it psychological roll cure, because the horses have been so backed off the bridle, it's as though they're afraid to touch the contact with the reins. What sort of thoughts do you have on that? Because it's not in that moment of pulling, but it's certainly holding a frame behind the vertical.
Mm-hmm, yeah. In our world, well, I know exactly. I have one picture in one of my books of a quarter horse backing up and super round in the top line, round from the tail down to the nose, like a almost like a melon.
Okay. Yeah.
And we don't have this, but we have similar situations. It's a big problem in our world too, that horses brace the back, curl in, and stay there. It's a big challenge to get these horses' nose out again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to get them to the bit. And my solution is short stirrups, half seat, and go. Let them go.
Mm-hmm.
Go forward. The forward, the active hind leg, the more you go, the more the haunches swing under in a natural way. They would loosen up the loin area. This forward, this stride forward loosens the loin and brings up the back a little bit. I'm sure you know, if you have a nice forward gallop, usually the trot work is better.
Right.
And also in some horses you sit higher. Suddenly you have more speed. And a forward motion causes balance, and the horse would come up and would take the and the horse above the bit would let the neck fall and take the bit also better. So I think forward is the solution, in at least with our horses.
Yes. Good. And I was losing a little bit of our signal right there, I think. But I think what we caught was that forward is the solution for all of that.
Hello?
Uh-oh. Can you hear me now?
I hear you. Yes.
Good. This is like a bad Verizon commercial.
Yes, probably.
Okay, great. So let's see. So I've got some kind of wrap-up questions, unless you have something else that you'd like to bring up that we could discuss. I think we can probably wrap up.
Yeah, I think we should. It's not a point I want to discuss. I would love to tell all our auditors that I think they should, everybody who, let's say, riding is like a virus infection, like herpes. Yeah, you never get rid of it anymore.
So
it's a lifelong disease. And if something lasts a lifelong anyhow, so why not try to learn it the best? And my suggestion is, if you have some experience and you have the age to be ready to read a book, get one of the old master's books. Yeah. Start with something and study, yeah? In your world, you have Tom Dorrance, you have Bill Dorrance, you have these wonderful books, you have Ray Hunt, you have these old masters in your world. I would call them old masters. We have our masters 200 years ago, up to 2005, Mr. Von Neindorf, the mm-hmm. last old master, I would say. And you must ride as many horses as you can get. So ride everything bigger than a sheep on four legs and read.
Yes.
Collect it. You need knowledge, and of course you need to ride. If you only ride one horse and maybe five in your life, it's very hard to learn to ride.
Absolutely.
You have to ride and ride and ride as many horses as you can get. The horses teach you.
Yes. Yes. That's so fantastic. So if there was one specific thing you could recommend riders to focus on as a primary means of improving their horsemanship or their dressage, either way, because I think they can be both the same. What would that be?
Well, there are so many things to recommend, but number one, in this country, you have a big advantage. I'm sure you have a high number of good cowboys in this country. Every dressage rider, everybody who rides a dressage horse should go to his neighbor and ask him if he would be allowed to sit on a properly trained horse. Because on this horse, he can learn to sit independently. Mm. So a person who is afraid that the horse might run away and the horse might bark, and this is why she doesn't want to give the reins, she could find her trust on a properly trained horse who's used to go in the loose rein, and a cowboy who could teach her a soft seat. This is so helpful just to develop a nice, balanced, relaxed seat. And this is the foundation for any type of riding. There's no difference. Yeah. If the seat is okay, then you can pick up a contact.
Yeah.
If you are stiff yourself, you cannot create a contact.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I come up with a quote from Mr. Steinbrecht from 1884, Gymnasium of the Horse. He said, "You cannot correct a rider's hand because this hand is created in the seat. If this rider has a wonderful, soft, harmonious seat, he has a beautiful hand. If there's something stiff and locked up in the seat, he has a hard mechanical hand. So the hand is only the expression of the seat." Mm. And this is a very, very interesting quote. And I think it's true. Yeah, it's my experience too. So every rider should work on his seat every single day he spends on horseback. Never forget the quality of your seat.
I love that. And in a conversation, actually another conversation that I had with Charles DeConfey, he made the comment that he wishes that most dressage riders would ride Western a little while, because the most, from what he sees, most Western riders can sit around the horse or sit in the horse, and most of the dressage riders just try to sit on the horse.
Exactly. That's it. This is this rhythm thing. As soon as you sit down and your swing melts into the horse's swing, you sit.
Yes.
And as long as you bounce on the horse's back as a foreign body, like a backpack full of stones,
right.
You are the horse. A German riding teacher calls it meat transport from A to B.
Oh, I'm probably going to end up using that line sometime. I love it. I love it. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so next in our wrap-up questions, if you could ride with anyone, past or present, who would it be and why?
Train with somebody.
Yes.
Or, well, as I mentioned, I love Ingrid Klimke. I have a few other professional riders in Germany I like very much. Your former dressage coach, I'm very much connected to him, Klaus Barkenhold.
Mm.
And I have a few people I respect very much, but not a single one is never made a mistake. Yeah, you will find a bad picture of anybody who wrote in public. So, but at least I can say these people try to do a good job and they do the best. I love to ride, and I learned a lot from a cowboy in Montana, a stepbrother of Buck Bellerman. Roland Moore is his name. Mm-hmm. I like very much his attitude. He showed me how he started the cult and so on. Meanwhile, this guy's, I think, end of 60s, and he's such a cool horseman. So I think in the Western world, there are many, many very nice and cool and riders who love their horses. Maybe they don't compete. I met a really cool guy in Durango in Colorado. I think in a symposium. He lives also in Montana. So there are many super horse people around. But finally, everybody is responsible for himself. Yeah. You cannot blame it to a trainer. I know many people say, but in our region, there's no trainer. I said, okay, so it's you are your best trainer because you ride every day with you.
Right.
You are there every day. So take care that you do the best you can. Teach yourself. And if there's a big challenge, ask somebody. And if you will find a solution. Everybody has a chance to improve.
So true. I love that. I love that. That is so true. Okay. So we've talked about your definition of dressage. What is your current present personal definition of horsemanship?
Okay. Well, I think this is the foundation of any riding, any discipline. Talking horses. Understanding the horse. The horse is not an intellectual living creature. The horse is a flight animal. The horse reacts. We are the part of this in this dance who acts. So we have to sort of adjust to the horse. We step into the horse's life, not the other way around.
Yes.
So we have to learn how a horse would react to other horses, to in certain situations, how they would interact in a herd, a stallion would react, whatever. The daily life with the horse, it starts with cleaning stalls, it starts picking a hoof up and whatever, helping a farrier. Being a good horseman, it's not only doing some tricks on the ground and pulling on a rope or not, but horsemanship is being a horse, thinking like a horse, acting like a horse, and making the horse trust you. Then you are a horseman. When the horse trusts you, you are a good horseman.
That sounds perfect to me. How can our listeners find you and information about your schedule and your books, your video, all of that?
So my publications all are printed and sold by Trafalgar Square. The publisher, Trafalgar Square.
Okay, great.
The contact to me, I have a Facebook site. My name, Gerd Holschmann. And then US, and you find all my travel agenda on this Facebook site. Or if you want to connect directly, there's a lady who organizes my trips to America.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Sandy Colling. Sandy Colling with a CollLing. She lives in California. And she organizes my May and my October trips twice a year since maybe 10 years or something.
Oh, 10 years. Wow. Okay. Great.
It's even longer, but she does it now since 10 years, I think, or maybe 8 years. I don't know exactly, but longer time. And she's a nice lady. She helps you to find me somewhere. Yeah, I'm all around the country.
Yes, absolutely. Sandy is an absolute gem. She and I have had many conversations about chasing you down and locking you down for this broadcast, and she's been absolutely great to work with. So many kudos to her for managing all of that for you.
Yeah, she tries to help everybody. She's really a very, very nice lady.
Yes.
She's German.
Yeah, there you go, right? Oh, fantastic. All right. So in all of these broadcasts that I do, we end with a question of the day. And this is a question that generally, if I'm doing a broadcast myself, I ask the question of the audience. And
okay.
Basically, it's anything that I pull off of the top of my head, really. It can
okay.
be any question about anything. And when I have someone with me, in this case, you, the guest gets to ask the question of the day for our listeners. And it's always an on-the-spot thing like this. So what would be our question of the day that we would ask our listeners?
So we ask our list. I ask our listeners the
yes.
question of the day.
Yes.
Okay. And who gets the answers?
Well, they'll be posting on my broadcast here, and so they'll continue posting after the broadcast ends. And I can certainly share this with you so that you can read everyone's answers.
Cool. Okay. So my question would be: give me your your definition to the term suppleness.
Ooh, I love it. That's going to get some great answers, I am sure. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Heuschmann, for joining me for this broadcast. This has been so much fun.
Yeah, I love it. And thank God we have guys like you who go forward and who give us a platform. And I hope that we make a difference one day.
I hope so as well. I hope so as well. Thank you. If I could have you hang on for a minute, I'm going to give us a closing here, and then I will be right back with you.
Okay.
So, gang, I want to thank you so much for tuning in for episode number 17 of Talking About Horses. I really appreciate you giving Dr. Heuschmann and I your ear. Please remember that if you've missed any of this, you can access the full broadcast here through Facebook, on YouTube, or by streaming direct from iTunes or wherever else you access your favorite podcasts. Through whatever outlet you're listening, please be sure to give us a rating, a comment, a review, and a share. Your word of mouth is the fuel for this fun fire that we have here. And please, gang, tune in next week for Talking About Horses when I'll be joined by my very good friend, Colton Woods.